The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, this is Alvaro Marañón with an episode from the Lawfare Archives for August 21st, 2021. The rapid developments in Afghanistan this past week, with the Taliban taking over, has created tremendous pressure for President Biden. The Taliban's quick action should also alert the Biden administration to focus on other threats, including terrorism around the world. For today's episode from the Archives, I've chosen a conversation between Aaron Zelin and Barak Mendelson from February 2nd, 2016, on Mendelson's new book, The Al-Qaeda Franchise, The Expansion of Al-Qaeda and Its Consequences. During this discussion, they cover, among other things, why and where Al-Qaeda decided to branch out, and the strategy behind that decision, how the organizations expand, and how other case studies on different Al-Qaeda branches have turned out.
I'm Aaron Zelin, founder of Jihadology.net.
And I'm Carl Morand, the show's producer. This episode features an interview with Barak Mendelson, an associate professor of political science at Haverford College and senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. He is also the author of the new book, The Al-Qaeda Franchise, The Expansion of Al-Qaeda and Its Consequences.
In this episode, we talked about this book, and in particular, how organizations in general expand, why Al-Qaeda decided to branch out and what its strategy was behind it, Al-Qaeda's choices on location of branch expansion, and case studies in Al-Qaeda's different branches.
After the interview, we'll have an updated hashtag social media segment covering postings from January 20th through the 31st. But for now, here's Aaron's conversation with Barak Mendelson.
Following the 9/11 attacks, Al-Qaeda began to branch out in a variety of locations, creating or merging with groups that we now know as AQAP, AQI, AQIM, Al-Shabaab, Jabhat al-Nusra, and others. In Barak Mendelson's new book, The Al-Qaeda Franchise, The Expansion of Al-Qaeda and Its Consequences, he explores these issues on a theoretical, empirical level, helping to explain AQ's decision-making related to its franchising strategy over the past 15 years. Today we have him on the pod to talk about it. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get to some of the nitty-gritty aspects of the case studies, can you maybe provide some background on how organizations in general expand and the different types of expansions?
I think it's what attracted me to the writing this book was the understanding that normally organizations will try to expand operationally. It doesn't have to, an organization doesn't have to open branches anywhere. It can just send people, create infrastructure in new locations. There is just no a priori reason why they would try to pursue a formal organizational expansion. So when I saw that Al-Qaeda adopted the branching out model, that was the first thing that stood up to me. And I started thinking about a typology of how do organizations, when they decide to expand organizationally, how they, the different models that they use. And I came up with four main or ideal type of expansions. The first one is absorption, where you basically, where a group brings other groups into its fold and absorbs them so that nothing really is left of the old identity of the organization. And the people in the old organization are just absorbed as individuals into the new organization. Then you have power sharing arrangements. This is two organizations that decide to integrate together and on its face maintain some parity. There is an understanding that both are equal and that they share objectives, and there is no significant hierarchy dimension in that arrangement. The third option that you have, and it's pretty common, and we see that now quite often in Syria, is an umbrella group. And that was actually the first organizational mode that Al-Qaeda chose when it started to expand or try to organizationally expand in 98. In an umbrella group, you have different kinds of organizations banding together, but they each maintain their old identity. There is definitely a lot of duplicating efforts, and they deal primarily with efforts to coordinate and to create a sense of unity, but without really investing too much in that. So this is also a solution or a framework that can be broken down pretty quickly. And then finally, you have the franchising model, in which you have a hierarchical element. The one organization is superior to the other groups that join it, but the different groups become franchises. They get instructions from above, but they maintain enough autonomy to act as they wish, of course, following the general strategic guidelines from the main organization. And in the book, I'm trying to suggest that this is what Al-Qaeda tried to do, and I'm trying to explain why it picked that method over the alternatives.
So then why did AQ, in your opinion, based off of the research that you've done, decide to branch out of all the other options?
There are a number of explanations. I think that probably the we need to start with the fact that, at least my understanding based on the research, it's not really clear that Al-Qaeda, when it did its first expansion in 2003, when it started with Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula in Saudi Arabia, that they actually thought at the time that it was creating a branch. When we look at the evidence, and in this subject, it's always difficult to get the clear picture, but we know now that the leaders of the branch in Saudi Arabia were not happy when Bin Laden gave the instruction to start operating. It all seemed pretty rushed, and for that reason, pretty quickly, the organization, the branch in Saudi Arabia that was based on Al-Qaeda operatives, not on mergers with any other groups, it was clear that they were not ready, and the Saudi regimes hit them pretty hard. Only a few months after they started operating, only then we started seeing them using the name Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And only a few months after they started operating, they released their journals, Saut al-Jihad and Muaskar al-Batar. And we know that Al-Qaeda pays so much attention to the media operations that it seems that when Al-Qaeda started operating in Saudi Arabia, it didn't really think yet of being a franchise. And there is a good chance that what happened in reality was that actors on the ground started using a certain name when they released media statements, and gradually it became known as a branch. And after that, Al-Qaeda Central thought about it and decided to adapt that as a model for expansion in the future. So there is probably an element of randomness in how things went. So that's one reason. A second reason is that while Al-Qaeda would probably prefer to do the absorption model because it increases your power, it didn't really have the ability to do that, especially as a transnational organization. you have to use persuasion in order to bring other actors under your fold. And since Al-Qaeda, most organizations would not want to just eliminate themselves and be absorbed under Al-Qaeda, in order to expand through absorption, Al-Qaeda would have needed to use coercive force. But at the time that Al-Qaeda started expanding, it didn't really have that much power anyway. So the option of branching out was the best alternative that it had that maintained Al-Qaeda as the superior organization and allowed Al-Qaeda to show that it's making progress. But in reality, that was less than Al-Qaeda probably would have wanted to have. So that's a second reason. A third reason is that Al-Qaeda at that point was facing significant difficulties. It miscalculated on before the 9/11 attacks. And when it had to deal with the aftermath, it saw that it's not ready to face the American forces. That's what it's doing is not really attracting either other jihadi groups or definitely not the Muslim masses. So Al-Qaeda was in a very deep hole. And then 2003 came, and the Iraq war was coming, and Al-Qaeda saw some kind of opening. It was an opportunity, but before opportunity, it was also a real challenge for Al-Qaeda. Because if the U.S., the main enemy of Al-Qaeda, came to the Middle East, came to Iraq to invade, and Al-Qaeda would not be present there, then it would put Al-Qaeda in a very negative light. And it will show its weakness. So the strategic conditions in the Middle East forced Al-Qaeda to try to show that it's still relevant. And since Al-Qaeda didn't have enough power of its own, there is a reason why in 2002 it had to turn to other groups like Jamaat al-Islamiyah in Southeast Asia to take actions, because Al-Qaeda itself was just besieged in the border area of Afghanistan and Pakistan. So Al-Qaeda had to show that it can do something, and it wanted to show that it can expand, and it wanted to show that it can still participate in the fight against the U.S., and the branching out model was the only model that could provide it that kind of those kind of opportunities.
Yeah, so can you explain then AQ's franchising strategy once they sort of figured out that this was the MO that they're going to use?
From my research, it seems that the first two expansions were pretty hectic. The expansion to Saudi Arabia was doesn't seem to be pre-thought or at least well thought through. Then Al-Qaeda wanted to get into Iraq, which was the main arena in the Middle East and was especially important since the failure in Saudi Arabia. But in Iraq, Al-Qaeda got into negotiations with Abu Musab al-Zarqawi and his organization, Al-Tawheed wal-Jihad. And the negotiations were pretty difficult. They broke down at least once. And they really reflected the different perspectives of Zarqawi and Al-Qaeda, which also manifests today in some way in the distinctions between Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. But it was so important for Al-Qaeda to show that it can still be relevant that it agreed to merge with Zarqawi's group under the conditions that and the strategy that Zarqawi preferred, which meant focusing on targeting Shia. And we saw how that worked. It's interesting also that the Iraqi expansion was the only one in which bin Laden himself announced the expansion. After those two cases, and both of them ended up with miserable outcomes for Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda seems to have learned, it tried to codify its expansions, and we can identify after that Al-Qaeda is learning from that bitter experience and considering again how it wants to make the expansion. So all the expansions after that, we see following some trend in terms of how you release the information. It's usually a video featuring Zawahiri and the leader of the organization that is joining Al-Qaeda or the branch that is now being created. And the expansions following Iraq, all of them are being done, are expansions in which Al-Qaeda is joining with groups that it doesn't judge as likely to undermine it or to cause problems. Clearly, it couldn't really know how useful they're going to be, but it seems that its assessment were that at least they would not be as damaging as its first two cases of expansion. Now, it didn't run to every place that it could expand to. It tried to be very selective, and this way it brought under its wings Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, the GSPC before that, following by expansions in Yemen, which is another in-house expansion, which means group that was based on Al-Qaeda forces and then gets the label of an Al-Qaeda franchise. Other kinds of learning that we see is that if in the beginning the political reasons made it necessary for Al-Qaeda to admit all its expansion efforts and to announce the franchises, later on Al-Qaeda is more careful. It tries to figure out the best time to announce an expansion and sometimes even decide whether expansion is actually worth it. In the case of Al-Shabaab, we saw that Al-Qaeda actually expanded to or started a relationship, branched out to Al-Shabaab, to Somalia, before it was announced. The documents from the Bin Laden compound in Abbottabad revealed that it seems that around 2010 already, Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab were affiliated together, even though only in 2012, Zawahiri formally announces that. So Al-Qaeda is trying to learn, yes, the expansions have political value, but you need to figure out what's the best timing. And the same thing we saw in Jabhat al-Nusra, where it was extremely important for Al-Qaeda to learn from past mistakes, especially the damage that the Iraqi branch caused the Al-Qaeda brand name. And in with Jabhat al-Nusra, Al-Qaeda, again, trying to make sure that Jabhat al-Nusra does not reveal the relationship with Al-Qaeda Central too early, before it gets a permission from Al-Qaeda Central and before it actually shows that it can be a constructive and effective actor in the Syrian arena, so that that will be something to compensate for the potential pitfalls of affiliating with Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, so maybe you could get into more specifics related to Al-Qaeda's sort of choices on location, since you had a full chapter on this and reasons why they might try and affiliate or join up with some other area or not at all.
So I try to examine three logics that we usually see in terrorism studies. One is the strategic logic, suggesting that terrorist organizations operate in order to advance strategic objectives. A second is organizational logic, which suggests that an organization is trying to focus on what will be best for the organization rather than political objective. And the third one focuses on ideology. Now, I don't believe that the distinction is very effective if you want to judge one over the other. But I think that all three logics were meaningful, and all three of them had some potential to affect the decision-making of Al-Qaeda. So when you think about what might lead Al-Qaeda to choose a certain arena, you can think about ideology. Ideology would suggest that there are some, that you will join an arena where you have jihadi groups operating already, or an arena where you operate against Muslim occupiers of Muslim lands. So trying to pay attention to those ideological aspects. When you think about the strategic logic, you think about expansion that will actually advance a strategic plan of Al-Qaeda. So you get into an arena that might be close to other important arenas, or an arena where access is easier for Al-Qaeda's foreign fighters to go into the new arena, or alternatively, a place where Al-Qaeda already has enough people located there, as it had in Saudi Arabia and in Yemen, which would therefore make it easier for Al-Qaeda to get in and to advance its organizational objectives. If you think about some of the places that strategically could be useful for Al-Qaeda, you have to keep in mind also that Al-Qaeda thinks about the historical appeal of some of those locations. So Iraq was clearly a place where Al-Qaeda could see that its strategic objectives could be advanced. The U.S. is already there. And in terms of the historical analogies, everything seemed to fit perfectly. It could use the idea that in the past the caliphate sat in Baghdad, that the demise of the caliphate in Baghdad is associated with a treachery by a Shia minister back then, and try to look at all those analogies as something that might attract people to join Al-Qaeda and therefore enhance Al-Qaeda's abilities in Iraq and outside of Iraq. And then when it comes to the organizational interest, Al-Qaeda definitely had to consider whether the organizations that it's bringing in, whether they will be destructive or not, whether they can help the whole set of groups under Al-Qaeda to flourish, or whether they will create a divergence between branches and Al-Qaeda Central. So these are some of the criteria that I wanted to examine in Al-Qaeda's decisions and to see which actually were more important. Now, of course, looking at all these cases together, and in the book I have 9 case studies. I'm using case studies of places where Al-Qaeda expanded to and places where Al-Qaeda avoided expansion. And when you look at all these, you can't really say that there is one master variable that explains all Al-Qaeda's decisions. And we shouldn't expect to find one, since the expansion decisions were happening gradually, and there is a learning process that affected how Al-Qaeda ended up expanding. But it still gives a very interesting view and allows us to actually see Al-Qaeda as a learning organization, how they figured out the branching out model. It's not that I believe that that model was a huge success for Al-Qaeda, but it was clear that within the bounds of its decision to expand organizationally, it learned over time how to do it in a more effective way.
Yeah, so that's a perfect segue to sort of the empirical side of the book. Maybe we could talk a little bit about the first expansions more in depth related to Saudi Arabia and Iraq.
So what happened in Saudi Arabia, I mentioned already that it doesn't seem like there was a decision by Al-Qaeda at that point to create a branch in Saudi Arabia. But Bin Laden was anxious to show activity, and Al-Qaeda had operatives in Saudi Arabia. A large number of Al-Qaeda operatives existed in Saudi Arabia. Many of them came after the American invasion of Afghanistan, escaped to Saudi Arabia. So when Al-Qaeda started creating an infrastructure, an operational infrastructure in Saudi Arabia, it actually had a large number of operatives, something like 1,000, which is quite a significant number for a terrorist organization. And Al-Qaeda, since Al-Qaeda Central was not able to do much under the American pressure, it became important for Al-Qaeda to operate elsewhere. And Saudi Arabia seems to be the perfect place for that. Bin Laden believed that he has lots of supporters, that his connections there and the glory of his old days in the resistance to the Soviets in Afghanistan will help him. Saudi Arabia is also, has always been for Bin Laden, the main grievance. We see in his declaration of war, he keeps mentioning the sort of occupation or the alleged occupation of Saudi Arabia by the Crusader American forces. And Saudi Arabia is not just any other place, even not any other place that is being occupied by the U.S. It is the place that hosts the two holiest places for Islam, therefore has significant religious symbolism. And since Al-Qaeda at that point didn't really have the capabilities to get into the Iraqi arena at a time that it became important, Saudi Arabia became the best alternative that they had. And Al-Qaeda tried in its propaganda to suggest that by taking action against Westerners in Saudi Arabia, it's actually contributing to the fight against the U.S. in Iraq as well. So Al-Qaeda started by, Bin Laden gave instructions and tried two different paths to create infrastructure in the Gulf. One of them was blocked due to the capture of an Al-Qaeda leader, but the other one, led by Yusuf al-Awyari, actually proved pretty effective in bringing together the different Al-Qaeda operatives and creating from different independent cells, creating a more organized, better bureaucratized group. Bin Laden then orders al-Awyari to start operating. And the first operation takes place in May of 2003, shortly after the U.S. invades Iraq. But Al-Qaeda is not ready for that expansion yet, definitely not ready to starting operations. And even though the news from Saudi Arabia appeared pretty alarming at the time, and of course the direct suffering of people that were affected is significant, in reality, in terms of promoting Al-Qaeda's strategic interest, the expansion to Saudi Arabia failed miserably. And very quickly, the regime cracked down on Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda found out that despite its belief that it's going to be received with welcoming arms by many Saudis, it saw that the Saudis were unhappy about terrorist operations inside Saudi Arabia, that for most Saudis, if you want to go and fulfill your jihadi duties, the place to do it would be in Iraq against American occupation, not in Saudi Arabia, where the conservatism still suggested that of the country still suggested that the royal family, with all its faults, still had much more significant legitimacy than Al-Qaeda anticipated. So Al-Qaeda found itself operating in an arena that was supposed to be welcoming, became pretty difficult to operate, and gradually the group in Saudi Arabia was decimated. The announcement of a branch or getting the signs of a branch actually paralleled the decline of Al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia, suggesting that in many ways the format of a branch in Saudi Arabia was also a way to politically compensate for the failures, the operational failures in Saudi Arabia. So that's about Saudi Arabia. The next expansion was in Iraq. And as I mentioned, Al-Qaeda miscalculated before 9/11. And as a result, when its plan to bring the U.S. into the Middle East actually materialized, it didn't really have the capability to face Al-Qaeda in Iraq. as a result, it had to turn to some kind of alternative, because not being in an arena like that also comes with costs. It's important to pay attention to that. It's not just about where you go in, but places that you are trying, that you are avoiding, can also reflect on you, and in some cases can reflect poorly on you. There is a reason why we see other jihadi groups constantly hammering Al-Qaeda for its absence from the Palestinian arena. How can you speak so much about the importance of Palestine and yet you're not really operating in the Palestinian arena? So Iraq was definitely a place that Al-Qaeda had to find a way in, but didn't really have the ability. The alternative was to just merge with a group that was already there. And Abu Musab al-Zarqawi did a pretty good job preparing for the Iraq war, creating an infrastructure, taking advantage of the power vacuum afterwards to expand his operation, expand the mobilization of volunteers. And so he was a very attractive partner. The problem was that it was also somebody that Al-Qaeda's leaders didn't like. Bin Laden met him already in 1999 in Afghanistan and immediately disliked him. It was only for the convincing of Saif al-Adel to try to suggest to Bin Laden that it's going to be useful to keep some friendly relations with al-Zarqawi that Bin Laden gave al-Zarqawi some seed money to open training camps close to the Iranian border. So we have this guy, Zarqawi, operating in Iraq, the relationship between him and Al-Qaeda, not great. His view of what should be the objectives of a jihadi group and who should be the main target, the strategy to operate, very different from the one that Al-Qaeda is trying to pursue. And as a result, there is significant divergence between the two organizations. And yet Al-Qaeda is so desperate to show that it's still relevant, to show that it has greater appeal, that it's still an important actor and that it has presence in the most important arena of the time, that it is willing to enter that relationship with somebody that's going to end up causing it significant harm over time, and that is successors will end up establishing the Islamic State of Iraq without informing Al-Qaeda Central and without asking for its authorization either. And later on, that same branch will become the Islamic State of Iraq and Asham, and what we see now as the Islamic State, basically a franchise that upstaged Al-Qaeda Central, became not just a competitor, but really an actor that is now threatening to eliminate Al-Qaeda. So the consequences of a poor choice in Iraq are just pretty incredible.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Yeah, we can still see the ramifications to this day. Moving to the expansions, spreading as you described it, of AQ branches in the middle of last decade, maybe you can talk a little about the expansions with Algeria, Yemen, and Somalia.
Sure. Algeria was a good opportunity. Algeria was a problematic place for jihadis, the memories of the war of the 1990s, the civil war, loomed large for the jihadi community. Most people, when they think about the civil war in Algeria, think about the brutality of the jihadis versus civilians. But a side story of what happened in Algeria was the infighting among jihadis. And what was especially important was how the GIA, the main jihadi group in the early 1990s, actually went against foreign fighters, volunteers, the jihadi volunteers that came to assist it. So when the GIA imploded and the GSPC came in its stead, it had already better relationship with bin Laden, but there was still significant distrust in the jihadi universe of the Algerians. But when the Iraq war began, the GSPC started reorienting itself towards towards global jihad, started creating connections with Zarqawi. Lots of Algerians made the way into the Iraqi arena. And slowly, gradually, the GSPC recovered the reputation or the positive image of Algerian jihadis and tried to show Al-Qaeda Central that it is a, it's going to be a useful partner for Al-Qaeda in the future. And after some negotiations, Al-Qaeda eventually was willing to bring the GSPC into Al-Qaeda. It wasn't clear, and I won't be surprised if Al-Qaeda Central believed that it's going to get more from the Algerian branch. But at the same time, at least it didn't seem to pay such a significant price for this kind of expansion. At that point, Al-Qaeda made sure that the expansion is going to be on its own terms. And even though it couldn't really supervise what happens in Algeria or make sure that the GSPC, now Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, is actually attacking the targets that Al-Qaeda Central would prefer rather than being engulfed in targeting Algerian local targets, domestic targets. Still, the sense was that this was not a huge gamble and that it showed that Al-Qaeda is still expanding. And we actually see these days that the Algerian branch is surprisingly loyal to Al-Qaeda Central. The elements within formerly within this Algerian branch that defected to the Islamic State. But overall, the leadership of Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb seems to be loyal to Zawahiri. And we see in the past year that they are releasing statements together with Al-Qaeda and the Arabian Peninsula suggesting close relationships. So that's the case of Algeria. I don't think that Algeria was a huge success, but Algeria was definitely a place that allowed Al-Qaeda to show that it's still relevant, that might be more useful in the future. And of course, today, when Al-Qaeda is fighting primarily against the Islamic State, having a branch in Algeria is important not as a force that will fight the U.S., but as a force that can stand against the expansion of the Islamic State. Now, with regard to Yemen, I'm trying to suggest in the book that expansion, you have two forms of expansion in the branching out model. One is that you can merge with other groups. But the more reliable form of expansion is to take people from your own group and in a way making some kind of organizational restructuring and giving your operatives in a certain arena an independent sort of autonomy and labeling them as a branch. So this is a sort of in-house expansion. And we saw it twice. We saw it once in Saudi Arabia, and we saw it for the second time in Yemen. Hardly surprising, since these are the countries that are mostly associated with bin Laden. And these groups tend to be, because they were already members of Al-Qaeda, tend to be a lot more loyal to Al-Qaeda Central. In 2006, when a number of Al-Qaeda operatives managed to escape from prison in Yemen, suddenly there was an injection of capable fighters that could start the Yemen branch. And in the beginning, they used the name of a name that specifically referred to Yemen. Over time, they managed to prove that they are useful. And I guess that at that point, you already have three other branches of Al-Qaeda. So it's not surprising that people in Yemen would have wanted to have a status of a branch. In 2009, eventually, we see members of Al-Qaeda escaping from Saudi Arabia and heading into Yemen. And when you have a critical mass of important Al-Qaeda operatives from Saudi Arabia converging, coming together with the Yemeni leadership of Al-Qaeda, then you have the opportunity for Al-Qaeda to announce the second iteration of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. As I said, the announcement of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula happens in 2009, but in reality, we can see a branch operating in Yemen already about 2 years earlier. As we know now, this Yemeni branch is the most loyal branch for Al-Qaeda. The deceased leader of the Yemeni branch, Al-Wuhayshi, that was killed last year, he was very close to bin Laden himself. And he is the first person outside of Al-Qaeda Central, the first one in the branches to get a very high position, basically being Zawahiri's deputy a few years ago after Al-Qaeda exhausted its bench of leaders in Afghanistan, Pakistan. So that's a good sign that Al-Qaeda Central believed that its Yemen branch is loyal and reliable. It's no surprise then that it's also going to be the, or was the branch that paid greater attention to trying to attack the West, not just Western targets in the Arabian Peninsula, but actually attacking Western targets as the Christmas bombing plot, I guess, is the best example for that. So the Yemeni branch is still active, and it seems like that was a wise Al-Qaeda decision. And the fact that they are now, when Al-Qaeda Central is struggling, it's Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula that is carrying the Al-Qaeda flag and making sure, coordinating with other actors, other Al-Qaeda branches, making sure to advance Al-Qaeda's strategic goals. So that's the case of Yemen. Somalia is a more complicated one. Because in Somalia, Al-Qaeda had very poor experience in the 1990s. It knows that the geography is very unpleasant. It knows that tribalism is prominent in Yemen, in Somalia, and that many times what it would see as an Islamist agenda or jihadi agenda will in reality be just different tribes or different power centers based on tribalism in Somalia, just trying to take use jihadi ideology to advance much narrower interests. But Al-Qaeda also understands that there are some benefits for maintaining positive relationship. And so when the leader of Al-Shabaab in Somalia at a time that Al-Shabaab expanded and did tremendously well, taking control of a significant part of Mogadishu even, then Al-Qaeda decides that it's going to hedge its bets. It's going to accept the appeals from the leader of the Somali, or Al-Shabaab, from Gudane, and it will create a relationship. But in order to avoid the fallback, the backlash from that relationship, it wanted to keep that relationship secret. And we saw in the Bin Laden letters that he's trying to tell the leadership in Somalia that the reason why he prefers not to make the affiliation known is because the Somali people have significant needs, and for that, to address those needs, it's important that Al-Shabaab would be dissociated from Al-Qaeda. How genuine those considerations were, I have my doubts, but we don't have clear evidence at this point. Later on, it's interesting that the formal announcement of the franchise or the affiliation with Al-Shabaab actually came at a time that both Al-Qaeda Central and Al-Shabaab are in decline, rather than at a time that Al-Shabaab did tremendously well. The affiliation comes in, the formal announcement comes at the beginning of 2012, after Zawahiri's replacing Bin Laden as the leader, and at a time where there are voices within Al-Shabaab, as were voices from Al-Qaeda individuals operating within Somalia that objected to that affiliation. So despite the people that complain, Al-Shabaab members that complained against their leadership, and despite the objections of Al-Qaeda operatives in Somalia, the pressure on both organizations seemed to have led them to decide to announce the affiliation formally. Of course, speaking about Somalia is always complicated. The situation keeps changing. At the time that Al-Shabaab did pretty well, the relationship between the two groups, between Al-Shabaab and Al-Qaeda, was not recognized. When Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab were doing poorly, that was the time that we see Al-Qaeda showing up and announcing the merger. And in some ways, this is a gamble, because Gudane is not a great partner. Gudane is actually going after foreign fighters. And because Al-Qaeda Central cannot restrain any unruly branch, Al-Qaeda is suffering the consequences of the purges that Gudane is conducting. Because now we are also in a very different social media environment. And so many of the many of the conflicts within Al-Shabaab is playing in the media. We all know about Omar Khamami, the American jihadi, and his use of social media to complain against the leadership of Al-Shabaab, to warn that his life is threatened, to warn against the way that Gudane treated the foreign fighters. And we see him, as well as other people, other leaders of Al-Shabaab, appealing explicitly through the media to Zawahiri to get involved, to do something to restrain the restrain Gudane. But Zawahiri doesn't really have the ability to do that. And the result is that we see Al-Shabaab, that all the dirty laundry of Al-Shabaab and the weakness of Al-Qaeda is being exposed for everybody to see, and Al-Qaeda Central doesn't really have any way to deal with that problem. So that's the issue of Somalia. Of course, Somalia, because the situation is fluid, we now see Al-Shabaab doing much better. So in this regard, and definitely after a new leadership, it might be that the Al-Qaeda bet on Al-Shabaab is not that disastrous. At the same time, of all the Al-Qaeda branches, Al-Shabaab seems to be the least reliable and where the threat of defection to the Islamic State is probably the highest.
So one of the interesting things you did in this book, besides looking at the expansion of the franchises by Al-Qaeda, was also sort of the non-decisions or sort of the duds in some ways. Can you talk about the cases of Egypt, Libya, and Palestine maybe?
Sure. The first one is the issue of Palestine is especially important. In Palestine, on its face, should be a place for Al-Qaeda to expand to. Al-Qaeda always suggested, its leaders suggested, that there is no subject that is more appealing to Muslims than the suffering of the Palestinians' brothers. And despite the rhetorical focus on Palestine, the suffering of Palestinians, the Jewish occupation. And we should remember that Al-Qaeda is paying significant attention, at least rhetorically, to the role of the Jews in the attack on Islam. So the fact that Al-Qaeda doesn't operate in the Palestinian Authority or in the Palestinian arena is a very important issue, and it exposed them to criticism. And yet, despite that criticism, Al-Qaeda did not start a branch in Gaza, definitely not in the West Bank. So what is the reason for that? My sense was that we can learn a lot from those non-events, at least as much as we can learn from the places that Al-Qaeda did choose to expand to. Operationally, expanding to the Palestinian arena is very complicated. Al-Qaeda noted many times that there are states bordering Israel that are protecting Israel's borders, and therefore it's almost impossible for Al-Qaeda to get in. If Al-Qaeda wanted to get in, getting into the West Bank was going to be very difficult. Going into the Gaza Strip was supposed to be easier. You can get through Sinai and use one of the many tunnels to get into the Gaza Strip. Or you can use some of the Salafi groups operating within Gaza. And yet, Al-Qaeda avoided that. And I attribute that decision to the primacy of Hamas in Gaza. Maybe some people would like to think that Hamas and Al-Qaeda are very similar, but we know that there are significant conflicts between them. Hamas is linked to the Muslim Brotherhood that have very different notion of how to advance political Islam than the jihadis of Al-Qaeda have. And the rivalry between Al-Qaeda and Hamas was actually pretty bitter, to the point that leaders of Hamas announced when to one of the statements made by Al-Qaeda people in Iraq, making very clear that they will never allow Al-Qaeda to operate within the Gaza Strip, to even get into the Gaza Strip. So if you can't really get into the Palestinian territories, the other option is to use forces that are already on the ground, the way that that Al-Qaeda did in Iraq, in Algeria, and in Somalia. But because Hamas was so dominant in the Gaza Strip, and Fatah is dominant in the West Bank, Al-Qaeda doesn't really have any way to create a sufficiently strong organization within the Palestinian territories that could then become its branch. And because there is also division between the different Salafi groups in Gaza, Al-Qaeda just decides that it's not worth the effort, that it's bound to fail, and it's willing to even accept the damage that it's going to, of absence from that arena to its reputation. So that's the case of Palestine. Now, the case of Egypt and Libya is somewhat different. In those two cases, Al-Qaeda actually announced expansion or affiliation with groups that were part of the Gamay Islamiya, the Egyptian Gamay Islamiya, and with the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. And yet I argue that none of those expansion efforts should be seen as genuine expansion efforts. What happened was that following the American invasion, most of the jihadis escaped from different nationalities, different organizations escaped Afghanistan. Many of them went back home if they could. Many of those that went back home ended up in prison. Some were arrested in other locations and were sent back home to serve in prison. But there were a few contingency of members from different jihadi groups that remained to operate in the tribal areas. So there was a significant group of Libyans, members of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, operating in Pakistan's tribal areas. In Iran, there was there were a few cells of former members of the Gamay Islamiya, Egyptian Gamay Islamiya. And these groups operated close to Al-Qaeda Central. So over the years, you can see how those groups are actually getting closer to Al-Qaeda because they are fighting and bonding on the ground. But they're also experiencing jihadism in a very different way than the leaders of the groups back in Algeria, back in Libya, and in Egypt. That creates significant distance. At a time that Al-Qaeda decides that it wants to expand, then it turns to these two organizations, to leaders that were close to Al-Qaeda, and it tries a gambit of announcing that they are joining Al-Qaeda. Part of the story is to try to show that Al-Qaeda is really expanding, and it doesn't really require this kind of expansion, don't require it to put too many resources. But another part of the story of Egypt and Libya is that these two groups, the people leading those groups in Libya and Egypt, are engaged in a process of self-reflection and writing refutation books, basically going against their old ways, and of course also writing things that, in the case of the Gamay Islamiya in Egypt, go directly, books that specifically criticize Al-Qaeda. In the case of the Libyan Islamic group, the final outcome was a book that doesn't really mention much Al-Qaeda, but it's very clear that is opposed to Al-Qaeda's ways. So the attempt to suggest expansion to Libya and Egypt are sort of a preemptive strike by Al-Qaeda, trying to reduce the appeal of the recanting leaders of those branches, and an attempt to maybe the best case, hoping that they will succeed by announcing the merger with those groups, Al-Qaeda will succeed to get some more people from within Libya and Egypt to decide that they want to join Al-Qaeda. But in none of those cases, we don't have any evidence that the announcement was preceded by any real efforts to create operational infrastructure for Al-Qaeda in those countries. So it ends up eventually as seeming primarily as a rhetorical effort with hope that maybe something will come out of that, but without really great hopes that it's going to happen. And in reality, those efforts failed pretty miserably. And at this point, it seems that Al-Qaeda decided that it doesn't even want to have an independent, autonomous Libyan branch now, as opposed to 10 years ago. Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb is actually responsible for Libya, something that in the past didn't happen.
Yeah, and then the final grouping of branches that have joined AQ in recent years, obviously, is the case of Syria, but also their Indian subcontinent branch.
Right. Syria was very tempting. Al-Qaeda, in general, prefers to go to an arenas where it's going to be received, when it's going to be welcomed by the other jihadi groups operating. And when you have a very split jihadi or Islamist scene, Al-Qaeda will be more reluctant to go in. It would like to see itself as a uniting force rather than as a force for division. And therefore, many times it would just wait for actors to, for the conditions to be more conducive for entering the arena. But in the case of Syria, it was important for Al-Qaeda Central to show up, and that interest corresponded to the interest of the leadership of the of Al-Qaeda, of the Islamic State of Iraq, and of the individuals that were sent from Iraq, that those 7-8 individuals that were sent in the summer of 2011 from the Islamic State of Iraq to start creating an infrastructure in Syria. Al-Qaeda instructed, Al-Qaeda Central instructed the people that went to form an infrastructure in Syria not to reveal their affiliation to the Islamic State of Iraq and not to reveal their affiliation with Al-Qaeda, hoping to get some time to create the infrastructure that it needs and hoping to create an appeal among the locals and among the established Islamist jihadi groups operating in Syria, so that when Al-Qaeda can feel ready to announce that Jabhat al-Nusra is its own branch, it won't have too many damaging effects. Syria was just a place that Al-Qaeda couldn't avoid. This was a very important arena. It's bordering many states in the Middle East. Everybody else is in that arena, so avoiding it would signal that Al-Qaeda is very weak. And of course, if your objective at the end of the process is to hit Israel, Syria also has a shared border with Israel. And Al-Qaeda had few people that it could trust in Syria. And so in Syria, it tried a new model of expansion, where it is trying to integrate itself within the local opposition in a way it didn't try before, and to create better relationships, hoping that that will help it in the future. And things went pretty well. Jabhat al-Nusra was very effective, and perhaps too effective because it became too independent for the liking of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and the Islamic State of Iraq, eventually leading him to announce the expansion of the Islamic State of Iraq into Syria. What's important to note is that despite all the upheavals that Jabhat al-Nusra experienced, it proved itself extremely resilient. The fact that they are that they managed to survive the entry of the Islamic State of Iraq into the arena, the announcement of the restoration of the self-styled caliphate, that despite all that, despite the efforts of the U.S.-led coalition to target Jabhat al-Nusra, despite all these efforts and internal conflicts within Jabhat al-Nusra, conflict with other groups, the fact that Jabhat al-Nusra is now so well embedded within the Syrian opposition, the fact that they managed to become the most important military force within the rebellion, that's nothing less than remarkable. It just proved itself to be extremely resilient. As for the Al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent, and that's where I try to end the book, I see that expansion as a matter of a response to the Islamic State's caliphate. The announcement comes about 2-3 months after Baghdadi announces the caliphate. Only Al-Qaeda doesn't really respond that much over that summer to the establishment of the caliphate. But then in September, it announces that it has now established a new branch in the Indian subcontinent. And while the announcement doesn't say anything explicitly about the Islamic State, it's clear that Zawahiri is trying to show the differences between Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. He speaks about a process of 2 years in which Al-Qaeda tried to bring different groups together, showing that Al-Qaeda, as opposed to the Islamic State, is a force for unity, that it seeks to bring different groups together rather than split them, that it works by persuasion rather than through coercion. And so in many ways, the case of AQIS is an example of Al-Qaeda trying to show that it's still operating, that it's still relevant, and also rebranding itself as the reasonable jihadi group. It was hoping that its first operations will be more successful. And it seems at this point, it's really hard at this point to see what is really the strategic logic behind the operations of AQIS. Its first operations focused on using, it tried to attack Pakistani ships, take over them, and get closer to American ships and try to target those American ships, really showing that Al-Qaeda is still attached to the objective of fighting against the United States, the main enemy, not the near enemy, the way that the Islamic State is operating. And it was a very daring operation, but it failed. And ever since, Al-Qaeda tried, the branch tried to do some kind of operations like that on the high seas that didn't bring much success. And after that, it's really hard to see what is leading the activity of Al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent. Perhaps it's nothing more than just a different name for Al-Qaeda Central. It seems that they were very important for establishing new training camps that the U.S. just revealed a few months ago, significant training camps in Afghanistan. So it might be that the real value of the new branch is just by the matter of branding, showing that Al-Qaeda is still active despite the expansion of the Islamic State. But operationally, it's still hard to see the important strategic contribution of the new branch.
Yeah, so what lessons do you think we can learn in terms of what IS has been attempting to do now since November 2014, when it created its own provinces outside of its core territory in Iraq and Syria? Or do you think this scenario is different because AQ and IS have different organizational ethos, as well as how they operate vis-a-vis the entities outside of their core territories?
They're different in many ways. First, Al-Qaeda is still an organization, while it's now showing more interest in management or in governance because the Islamic State created new standards and governance seems to be necessary. Al-Qaeda is still very reluctant to pursue that unless it has to. Bin Laden himself was pretty critical of the notion of the idea of focusing too many energies on establishing new emirates. And he preferred to continue to work as a terrorist or insurgency organization rather than to create emirates that will distract Al-Qaeda, that will expose Al-Qaeda to external forces, and that will take lots of resources that Al-Qaeda could use for the main fight against the United States. So contrary to Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State is trying to pursue a different trajectory where it sees itself as a state, and territoriality and governance are central to its advancement. So while there are some similarities in the process, both actors see themselves in very different terms. Of course, they also have differences in their other elements of their strategy. Al-Qaeda is still saying that it's focused primarily on the U.S. So any efforts of expansion that will be kind of the provinces that the Islamic State is creating, just not going to be very useful for promoting that objective. On the other hand, for the Islamic State, its focus is on trying to expand, first of all, in the Middle East, in countries that are dominated by, have Muslim pluralities. And by establishing provinces, the Islamic State is not just trying to expand the Al-Qaeda style. Establishing provinces is also a way to fight Al-Qaeda. There are some provinces of the Islamic State that the Islamic State doesn't have much significant infrastructure in those places and doesn't really engage in at all in governance. But the Islamic State's claim, since they are now a caliphate, then everybody, all Muslims, must pledge bayah, to pledge of allegiance to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. And in any place that the Islamic State is expanding to, all Muslims must, not just all Muslim groups, all jihadi groups especially, must dismantle themselves. They are no longer valid, and they all owe a pledge of allegiance to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. So in some ways, the announcement of wilayas by the Islamic State is not just a matter of showing that it can expand. It's not always a case of bringing governance, but it's an effort to directly challenge Al-Qaeda in all locations that Al-Qaeda exists by bringing into light the problems of allegiance. And the fact that the Islamic State, seeing itself as a state, believes that all Muslims and all groups owe its allegiance. And so the expansion through provinces is also a way to delegitimize the existence of Al-Qaeda in all those locations and provide a channel for disgruntled or just unhappy Al-Qaeda operatives that would like to join the Islamic State that seems just much more successful these days. So I think that these aspects make significant differences and might explain to some extent why the Islamic State is following a model of not of an organizational expansion, but of state building.
Yeah, well, we still have a lot of ways to see how this is all going to play out, whether for Al-Qaeda or for the Islamic State. But thanks for coming on to the show today, Barak, and talking about a really interesting subject.
A pleasure.
This episode's hashtag social media segment will cover postings from January 20th through the 31st.
During that time span, five foreign fighters with various groups were killed in Syria, while Ansar al-Sharia in the Arabian Peninsula, who will be referred to as ASAP going forward, which is a front group of AQAP, announces that it conducted 15 military operations in Yemen.
On January 21st, Wilayat Tarablus of the Islamic State shows off a furniture store in Sirte, Libya.
Also on the 21st, Jabhat al-Nusra distributes blankets and aid to ordinary Muslims in the city of Abu Zahur, Syria.
On the 21st as well, ASAP distributes relief aid to the needy in Al-Mukalla, Yemen.
Also on January 21st, Wilayat Salah ad-Din of the Islamic State shows off the work of an onion farm in Iraq.
And on January 21st as well, Wilayat Barakah of the Islamic State fixes electrical lines in al-Shaddadi city, Syria.
On January 22nd, Wilayat Ghur of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan conducts a dawah session.
On the 22nd as well, Wilayat Ghur of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan distributes its Tora Bora magazine to tribal chieftains.
On January 23rd, one foreign fighter from Syria was killed in Iraq with the Islamic State.
On January 24th, Jabhat al-Nusra does maintenance on the water pumps in Aleppo, Syria.
On January 27th, ASAP fixes the electricity in Al-Mukalla, Yemen.
On the 27th as well, ASAP cleaned the streets in Lahaj, Yemen.
Also on the 27th, ASAP repaves roads in Al-Mukalla, Yemen.
On January 28th, one foreign fighter from the Netherlands carried out a car bomb attack in Yemen with the Islamic State.
Also on January 28th, ASAP confiscates toxic chemicals in Waqar, Yemen.
On the 28th as well, ASAP provides medical care to residents in Al-Mukalla, Yemen.
On the 28th also, Wilayat Nineveh of the Islamic State constructs a park for children in Al-Qusur area of Mosul City, Iraq.
On January 29th, Wilayat Tarablus of the Islamic State conducts a Sharia course for ordinary Muslims.
On January 30th, Jabhat al-Nusra cleans the waste from the streets in Aleppo, Syria.
On January 30th as well, Wilayat Hadramat of the Islamic State shows off its medical center in Yemen.
Finally, on January 30th, ASAP destroys a polytheistic shrine in Wadi Sir, Yemen.
If you have any feedback, you can email us, podcast@jihadology.net, or find us on Twitter, where we are @jihadpod. If you're a fan of the show, please check out the Patreon link in the show notes, where you can make a small donation to help support the podcast. As always, the show can be found on Stitcher as well as iTunes, and if you use one of those platforms to subscribe to the show, please take a moment to rate and review it, which will help more people discover the podcast.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Jihadology podcast. Thanks to Barack for coming onto the show and sharing his expertise with us. Also, thanks to the podmaster, Carl Moran, for making sure this podcast sounds and runs smoothly. Until next time, I'm out.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.